Well, welcome back to the Shift Extension Podcast. I'm Nick, and joined once again by Sonny Whitfield. How are you, mate?
Good, Nick. Good. Excited about today. Going to be exploring an interesting case.
Yeah, so we've got another case study for our listeners today, and hopefully some learnings will come from it. What's today's topic?
We're going to be looking at anaphylaxis. Now, this is a reasonably controversial subject quite often. Certainly has been controversial through most of my career because I've seen the definition of anaphylaxis change several times. I've also seen clinical approaches towards anaphylaxis change and also our interventions change. So it's certainly a constantly evolving thing. And when things are constantly evolving like this, it quite often means we don't fully understand what we're actually dealing with. And that's there's an irony there, considering we are often called to these things to I guess intervene and assist. So we're going to be looking at anaphylaxis. We're going to be looking at a case study that's not your average anaphylaxis presentation. But I guess before we even get to the case study, we should have a quick chat about what anaphylaxis is. When we first started over a decade ago, Nick, would it be fair to say we were certainly educated that anaphylaxis it was a severe allergic reaction, but we needed to have multi-system involvement or multi-body system involvement?
Oh, 100%. Like the teaching of the day was that these patients were, you know, in a life-threatening state. They had respiratory issues, they had skin issues, they had the cardiovascular collapse, and they had multiple systems for you to diagnose that patient with that condition and start to treat in such a way.
And a lot of us back then were also differentiating between, you know, severe allergic reaction would be one body system, whereas if it was multi-system, then we were, often diagnosing this as anaphylaxis. It was the very definition of what we're using. But we've seen an adaption to that occur recently in the last few years where, you know, anaphylaxis, it's a potential life-threatening syndrome. That's essentially a severe allergic reaction, and it should be treated as a medical emergency. It's quite vague. And I mean, that definition comes from the Australasian Society of Clinical Immunology. So with such a vague kind of definition, it challenges paramedics to actually appropriately diagnose. How many of these have you been to over your career?
A few. And sometimes they're very obvious, and sometimes they're quite subtle and difficult to try and differentiate from other conditions. And that's where, you know, a thorough physical exam, pointed questioning is going to help you kind of differentiate. Is this, you know, is this anaphylaxis? Is this something I should treat? Is this something I shouldn't? Maybe is anaphylaxis a condition diagnosed as something that responds to adrenaline? Maybe the diagnosis happens after the treatment.
It's challenging. You said that some have been obvious, some of them not so. If we're talking about the some of the obvious cases, how did they present? What manifestations did you see? I should say see here or observed.
So you see a lot of what in my experience is different to other people's experience, purely based on the roll of the dice of the patients that you see in your time. It's a combination of skin features, respiratory and cardiovascular collapse. Certainly you get a few patients with some GI upset. I haven't seen a lot of patients with really catastrophic airway involvement. You do a little angioedema, the tongue's swollen, the face is swollen, but like that true life-threatening stridor, I haven't seen a lot of.
It's important too to differentiate between that true life-threatening stridor, that true constriction of the airway and people's genuine panic at feeling, slightly compromised. Their panic can certainly affect us in our own assessment of that person.
But I think because we've had such a variety of presentations of anaphylaxis, it confirms that maybe we need to move away from that traditional diagnosis of I need to have two body systems, or my patient needs to be on the precipice for me to be thinking about treating them as anaphylactic.
Now, certainly a big part of diagnosing these for me over my career has been gathering a really good history of this patient. I guess it simplifies the process if we find out that they have existing allergies to something already and or they've been exposed to those within, the most recent time frame. So gathering that really good history has certainly simplified this. But I think you're right. We need to, reevaluate how we're assessing these. So do you want to hear the case?
Let's do it.
I read about it a few weeks ago, published online. So there was a paramedic crew who were actually sent to assist a 29-year-old female patient, and it came through as a query allergic reaction in a residential apartment. So it was up a few flights of steps, an elevator to the apartment. They were also backed up by a second solo paramedic, just based on some of the information that was coming from scene. When the first crew actually arrived, they found a patient who was in obvious respiratory distress. So I guess we can look at one body system there. The patient was anxious and unable to speak in full sentences, which would, I guess, cause some alarms. There was also an obvious red rash all over her chest, arms and neck, with some associated facial swelling. So, I mean, it would have been a confronting scene whenever you're presented with a patient who feels like their life is at threat. They are obviously anxious, nervous, and generally upset, and normally that does obviously affect our approaches to it. But there are some alarm bells here, and I mean, if I walked into this apartment, I would be looking at this as a multi-system event. The history would obviously need to come next. Now, during that verbal exchange they had, and it was obviously difficult because this patient was unable to speak in full sentences, it was ascertained that this patient had severe existing allergies to eggs, dairy, and iodine, but they were unable to actually isolate a potential trigger for this event. The initial vital signs taken for them too would start putting them obviously on path for a differential of anaphylaxis. Heart rate of 130, mm-hmm. So elevated, had a shallow respirator 30, so also elevated, and dropping O2 saturations down to about 90% room air. So I guess with those vital signs and that history, what would you be thinking, Nick?
Well, the history sounds like anaphylaxis. Mm. There's a lot of red flags there. You've got a patient who has multiple allergies already. There's a good chance she may have encountered something else that she's allergic to. And you've got a patient who's anxious. She's hypoxic despite having an elevated respiratory rate, which is a red flag. So based on the history, the physical exam and the vital signs, it appears that this patient's having an anaphylactic reaction.
Mm. And look, it's never my intention in these case studies to criticise anyone because, you know, we weren't there. Mm. It's interesting, though, when we look at how this patient was presenting with the vital signs, it does look like it's going to be a severe allergic reaction slash anaphylaxis. What happened, though, is that the backup paramedic arrived almost 8 minutes later, and what they found is the crew on scene were extraordinarily hesitant to administer adrenaline. Now, adrenaline is the frontline management for severe allergic reaction. They hadn't actually administered it yet, and it was because during the vital signs survey, they recorded several blood pressures of upwards of 160 on 110. So you've got a hypertensive anaphylactic patient. When we talk about, I guess, the standard presentation of an anaphylactic patient, I guess most of us are expecting to see a patient who would be hypotensive because of the histamine release, the chemical release that's occurred. And so getting a hypertensive patient is it's a little bit of a redirect. Mm. BGL was 5.8, temperature was 37.4, GCS 15. So really when we're exploring this case and unpacking it, it is the only anomaly that would not be what we expect to see. Would that, and it's difficult to put yourself in that position, in your experience, would that change your course of treatment or your line of management for this patient?
I can understand the crew's concerns, mm-hmm. But it wouldn't change my management.
No. Okay, so you would still be looking at this patient that with all the information that you have, you're fairly certain that this is an anaphylactic patient.
Yeah. And you have to ask yourself, why are they hypertensive?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if this patient's got features of anaphylaxis, if we think about and we understand anaphylaxis from a pathophysiological perspective, then we can start to put meaning around why they could have a blood pressure of 160 on 110. Now, we go back to, you know, understanding the idea of shock, right? And the different stages of shock, mm-hmm. our compensatory stage and our decompensatory stage. Remembering that when we start to have shock, the body's going to start to compensate for it and start to elicit some of those compensatory mechanisms, such as vasoconstriction. So the baroreceptors, when they start to have a reduction in volume coming towards them, they can see this and cause some vasoconstriction, tightening of the vessels. Our renin-angiotensin aldosterone system is going to be activated in the kidneys. All these things are there to try and preserve the volume within the vasculature, right? So a manifestation of that is acute hypertension. You can see it in STEMI patients when they first have their STEMIs or their occlusive myocardial infarctions. You know, the heart becomes a bit stunned. There's a small degree of cardiogenic shock. We see a rise in their blood pressure. When we become hypertensive, we're now at a point of decompensation, right? We're now further down the line of the trajectory of shock, right? So if we understand the nitty-gritty of the presentation in front of us, it can either reassure us that what we're seeing is normal mm-hmm. or to be expected, but also allow us to better risk stratify the interventions that we want to provide, right? So let's say we go to this patient and, you know, they've got a blood pressure of 160 and 100 and they're 94 years of age and they've had a stroke before and they've got cardiovascular disease and they're in an arrhythmia. And you go, I could see how, yes, it's not unreasonable, but they're going to be hypertensive, but there's a lot of risk here.
Mm-hmm.
But for a 30-year-old female who's otherwise well, you know, now we're playing this risk-benefit of, you know, yes, I'm concerned, but am I concerned enough to withhold an intervention that I know is going to treat this condition? That's another level of thinking that we can start to explore.
It's certainly a consideration, isn't it? I guess I do understand, you know, why it would have surprised them.
Mm.
Like you point out, it's a 29-year-old female.
Yeah.
So when we look at a risk versus benefit matrix, it's probably safe enough to actually intervene at this point because what she really needs is she needs that adrenaline.
Yeah.
And
what do we do? Do we wait and see what happens? Do we give a full dose? Do we give a half a dose? Do we try other medications first and see what their effect is? You know, this is all depending on what knowledge we have, what experience we have, what's in our bank of ideas that can help us to make a decision. They're all going to influence how this plays out.
Understanding our tools too. I mean, synthetic adrenaline, depending on where we are and who we're working for, it's going to be anywhere from 300 to 500 mics
mm-hmm.
Or micrograms. When we consider the half-life of this drug too, it's relatively safe.
Mm.
You know, it's an interesting case to look at. And again, it's not ever our intention to criticise our colleagues. It's to explore these things. I like to try and put myself on scene and wonder, how I would have responded to these. And I think it would have surprised me to find a hypertensive patient. But ultimately, I see a patient who is who's a high risk of deteriorating further.
And I think when we start to reflect on cases, whether it's cases that we've been to or we're reflecting on the work of other clinicians, it's not about asking whether or not what they did was right or wrong. We have to ask ourselves, was the decision they made with the information they had at the time reasonable, right? And it's reasonable to suggest that a crew would be concerned about that blood pressure in this presentation, mm-hmm. right? Doesn't mean it's right. That it doesn't matter. It's whether or not it's a reasonable decision.
So the third paramedic, who's actually the second crew member to arrive on scene, obviously had the benefit of more observational view, could see the whole scene and recognise the urgent need of this patient requiring some intervention. And so the patient was administered, it says here, 500 micrograms of intramuscular adrenaline, high flow oxygen, and then the patient was further administered nebulized salbutamol, 5 milligrams, with some Atrovent as well, which all resulted in a really positive outcome for that patient on scene. Did her blood pressure go up? It did go up slightly, according to the case study, but nothing that would significantly alter her current risk profile. Mm. So the question I have, Nick, is... what's the reason, or what would be some of the reasons why an experienced paramedic crew would withhold something that was obviously needed for so long. Where can we learn from this? Where can we improve our own practice? Because, again, you know, I wasn't first on scene. I certainly wasn't on scene at all. And I like to think I know what I would have done, but I would like to explore why I may not have.
So I think, like, if we start to think about the mindset of the treating team, they would have recognised this lady was having an anaphylactic reaction. So the hypertension, the blood pressure of 160 on 110 in isolation, there would be concerns there great enough for them to be worried about treating this patient with adrenaline, right? This might be based on their own previous experiences with adrenaline,
mm-hmm.
might be based on the context of their learning and education, might be the context of the general attitudes of the work group for which they work in.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of different factors there.
A term I've heard used in the past is pigeonholing. You know, paramedics are at risk of pigeonholing themselves sometimes. Can you expand on what that means?
So I guess the idea of pigeonholing is that sometimes we get into the process of pattern recognition, right? So we look for certain patterns in our patient's presentation to help us form a diagnosis.
And when it doesn't fit that bill?
100%. So when it doesn't fit that bill, it's confusing and we're not sure what to do. And some of this is a legacy of how we were taught, of if we give you a set of patterns that fit 80% of how a certain condition presents, then you should be able to pick up most of that condition.
So do you mean like anaphylaxis must be multi-system
Correct.
Involvement?
Right. So if I teach you that anaphylaxis is a multi-system involved disease and 80 to 90% of those, I'm just spitballing numbers here, 80 to 90% of anaphylaxis present that way, then I have the confidence that you as a clinician should be able to identify most patients.
But there will be some I miss.
Always be some, because remember, patients don't read medical textbooks. Patients present all kinds of different ways. And sometimes what happens is when they don't fit our pattern or our perception of how they should, we don't know how to deal with that situation. And the best way to deal with it is to, you know, risk stratify it.
Mm-hmm.
Break it apart, pull it apart, you know, and it isn't always a right or wrong answer, right? That's the exciting thing about medicine, is that we work in the gray. There isn't necessarily a black and white.
No, and you've got broken information, you've got limited information, you've got a lot of competing factors. Every place and every patient you see, that all obviously influence what we're doing. But
and that's where, like, consultation has become such a big part of medicine.
Right.
It's a safety mechanism whereby when we have situations where we're a bit confused or conflicted or things don't quite fit the way we think they should fit, we can engage another healthcare professional to help us make the best and safest decision for a patient. That's the beauty of that, because we work in this kind of grey, you know, ever-changing dynamic environment.
Which is the benefit, too, of having this this third paramedic arrive on scene, you know, that just gave a new set of eyes and a new set of experiences to actually apply to the case, which actually seemed to work in the patient's favour and the crew's favour on this one. So,
and that's a perfect example of how collaboration and, you know, a team coming together and using the team's different experiences that ultimately resulted in an outcome for the patient. Perfect example of that working.
Interestingly, we spoke recently about a case and the paramedic's own bias. And when we talk about, you know, different experiences, inherently what comes with that is also differing biases on things. And, you know, when we talk about pigeonholing or siloing, you know, this is what this case should look like, and then it doesn't. Our own bias tells us, well, it should. And I'm sure that's what causes some of the confusion on scene. I've been there many times myself. I've been very unsure. And I think one of the best strategies, as you correctly pointed out, is that ability to consult with each other, colleagues, you know, higher skill sets, lower skill sets, equal skill sets, just having someone else to actually bounce the idea off, but also having the courage to say, hey, this is something that's outside the ordinary. This is not what I expected. What do you think?
Mm.
Mate, that that's a really interesting case study. I've actually thoroughly enjoyed exploring this.
That was great. We've got some exciting topics coming up in the next few episodes, so stick with us. If you have any questions or concerns about anything we've discussed, please reach out to us. But I think that's it.
Awesome. Thanks, mate.
Thank you.